What?
Escaped?
Her heart lifted at the idea. How easily, she thought, despair could turn to hope. At the foot of the staircase, Jane looked around the corner. The hall was enormous, but empty for now. If she kept to the shadows, she wouldn't be spotted, hopefully. And then she could escape the tower, find Edward. But first, she had to rescue her horse. 18. Gifford. Burned at the stake. A most unpleasant way to go, G thought. When he was just a boy of 5, he'd witnessed a man being burned at the stake. It was 1538, and John Lambert had been outed as an Ethian when, after hearing Frederick Clarence had written a pamphlet denouncing Ethian magic, he turned into a dog and ate the papers, prompting Clarence to cry out, "That dog ate my script work!" Lambert was sentenced to be burned at the stake, and Lord Dudley had insisted that his children attend the execution. He later told G that nobody trusted those with the ancient magic, and the country would be safer if every Ethian suffered the same fate as Lambert, which at the time G's father had seemed to truly believe. All G remembered of that day was the scream that seemed to go on for an eternity, that and the smell. He glanced at the lone candle his captors allowed in his locked tower room, and then looked closer at the small flame on the wick. Never had something so innocuous seemed so ominous. He held his hand over the flame.
"God's teeth!" he exclaimed, pulling his hand back after a mere instant. He hadn't felt so much pain in his entire life, which, in the next instant, he decided was a sad statement, because what 19-year-old man has only ever felt the pain of a candle on his skin? One who spends most of his nights attending plays and poetry readings. He sighed. Usually he composed stanzas in his head to calm his anxiety, but at the moment G had no desire to find a phrase that rhymed with charred flesh. He examined the palm of his right hand, expecting to see burned skin, but of course there was nothing, not even a little red. Now that the pain had subsided, not that there'd been very much of it to begin with, he turned his thoughts toward Jane, specifically the way she'd refused to denounce him as a heretic. He closed his eyes and remembered her confident posture as she stood by him, so sure in her decision, even though she could have easily sacrificed him to buy her own escape. She wouldn't betray him. Foolish, loyal, beautiful girl. At least her death would come much quicker than his. He looked out the window. From this vantage point he could almost see the place where Jane would suffer her fate, inside the courtyard of the tower. For G, though, he knew, he would be executed on Tower Hill, where the rest of the common criminals and heretics took their last breaths. That's where he'd be burned. It was a sad day when he yearned for a nice, tidy beheading. Instead of trying to compose morbid poetry, to be or not to be, that was the question. He decided to carve a name into the stone wall. Jane's name, of course. Jay. Jane. He wondered if she was thinking of him, too. If he would ever see her again. A. He'd never see a lot of people again. He'd never kiss his mother on the cheek or make fun of Stan, who wasn't so bad, was he? Not really. It had been unfair for him to resent Stan all this time, G thought. He'd never give Billingsley another ridiculous order, or make Tempy laugh, or try to irritate his father just to see the aggravation on the old man's face. N. His father. G chipped harder at the stone. His father, who had orchestrated this entire mess, who would undoubtedly be fine so long as he could switch to the winning side. who'd let his own son burn if it would save his life. G decided that he couldn't think about it any more. He put the finishing touches on the E of Jane's name, and then paced around the room looking for something, anything, to get his mind off burning flesh. He found a few books, skimmed through the first few pages of each, and then tossed them one by one to the side. Maybe this had been meant to be Jane's room. She was probably locked somewhere with a barrel of apples. A soft flutter at the door made him stop his pacing. Someone had slipped a piece of parchment underneath. He hurried over and unfolded it, and saw Jane's familiar handwriting. His heart pounded. He'd never received a love letter before, and although he knew his letter would most likely also be a goodbye letter, he felt some wild hope that she would confess some depth of feeling for him.
"Dearest Edward, I hoped to visit you this morning, but when I arrived at the palace, I was informed that you are not receiving visitors. I must confess my surprise and disappointment that you would not see even me, but I know there must be a good reason, and I suspect that this self-imposed isolation means that your illness is taking its toll. For this, I am so very sorry, cousin, and I wish there was something I could do to make you well again. I'm sure you must be wondering what it is I came to see you about this morning, mere hours after my wedding. My dear cousin, the wedding is precisely the topic I wanted to discuss with you, or rather, my newly acquired husband. Gifford is a horse. I'm certain you knew this, what with your referrals to his condition and assumptions that I would find it intriguing. What I cannot fathom is why you chose not to tell me. We've always told each other everything, have we not? I consider you to be my most trusted confidant, my dearest and most beloved friend. Why, then, did you neglect this rather critical detail? It doesn't make sense. But perhaps in this, too, I wonder now, you felt you had a good reason. I hope that we will be able to speak more on this subject when I return from my honeymoon in the country. All my love, Jane.
G refolded the letter, resisting the urge to crumple it up and toss it in the corner. He wasn't offended by her surprise at his condition, but did she need to sign it All My Love? All her love seemed a little excessive. It was abundantly clear to G that Jane loved Edward. He'd never forget the look on her face when she'd been told that the king was dead. But had she loved him? Was she thinking about her cousin right now, preparing herself to join her beloved in death? Not that it really mattered. G tried to shake his insecurity away and instead be grateful to whoever had given this to him. His wife's hand had written this letter. He could picture her face as she wrote it, her mouth pursing and brow furrowing the way it did when she concentrated. He was about to place the paper in his own coat pocket when he noticed something written in different handwriting near the corner of one of the folded edges. It was one word. Skunk. Well, that was a surprising word. No beauty in a word like skunk. He didn't recognize the handwriting. But no matter who wrote it, it was his only connection to Jane. G placed it in his breast pocket and for a moment pressed it against his chest. Sometime later, he heard a scratching coming from the door. G shook his head, chalking the noise up to random castle creaks and groans, but then he heard it again, a distinct scratching sound. He raised the candle, which only had an inch of light left, and walked cautiously to the door, just in time to see two beady little eyes peeking in from underneath. He barely had time to register the eyes when an entire furry body snaked its way inside his chamber flat against the ground. G yelped and stepped back. He definitely did not scream like a little girl. Once it passed the doorframe, the creature seemed to puff itself back into shape just as G grabbed the nearest thing he could chuck at it, a pillow. He took aim and threw it, but the little rodent dodged. It was too long to be a mouse or a rat, but too short to be... What other kind of rodent was there? It looked like a cat and a snake had a baby together. G stalked over to the thing and stomped his foot near it. "Go away, you scruffy squirrel!" The creature shied away from his foot, and he stomped again in the direction of the door. "Shoo! There's nothing to see here! Go on out the way you came in!" But the rodent made no move toward the door. Instead, it scurried over to the bed and scampered up the hanging tassels to the bed covers and then to the head of the bed, where it nestled itself down on top of one of the pillows. "Get off, you nasty rat!" G grabbed one of the books he had discarded and raised it above his head. At this, the rodent sprang to attention on all fours, long tail fluffed out. G waved the book as a threatening move, and the rodent did the strangest thing. It moved its head in a side-to-side motion, mirroring the motion of the book, its beady eyes wide and fixated on the tome. G jerked the book forward about an inch, and the rodent flinched. "All right, let's come to an agreement." G gently lowered the book to the bed, and that's when the rodent did something even stranger. It scurried over to the book and nestled on top of it like a mama bird would nestle over her eggs. "Wait. Jane?" G said. The rodent made a nodding motion. "Jane?" he said again. The rodent nodded again, this time in a more exaggerated way. "Jane, you're a rat!" Jane froze, and then darted frantically around the bed, then around the room, then scaled the bedpost and darted in and out of the tassels. G was worried she would do something crazy, like hurl herself off the bed to her death. "Wait, wait, you're not a rat! I only said rat because, well, I wasn't thinking, but you're not a rat!" She froze on top of the bedposts, waiting expectantly. She wanted him to tell her what she was. "You're well, it's actually something I've not seen, maybe ever. But you have fur, beautiful fur," he added when she started shaking, "and two lovely eyes, four strong, if tiny, legs, but not too tiny," he added again. "Can you please come down from there before I continue?" She stamped her foot before climbing down the poster. He could almost hear her huffing. Lord, it was so obvious she was Jane. How had he not known the second her beady eyes appeared under the door? She settled herself on the bed, and he sat down next to her. He was tempted to pet her as he would a dog, but he resisted. She might find that demeaning. He faced her. "Okay. So you are an Ethian," he said, opting for the safest reference to her appearance. "I don't suppose you're a typical Ethian who can change back and forth at will, otherwise you would have changed back to tell me who you were yourself?" He paused. "I know that sounded very roundabout, but my meaning is, you can't control the change, can you?" She nodded. "Yes, you can't control the change, or yes, you can." He realized how stupid the questions were. "Never mind. I'll phrase it this way. Can you control the change?" She shook her head. "All right. We are getting somewhere. Although very slowly, and I worry about how quickly the sun will soon be rising. So what are we going to do?" He sighed. "If only we had a horse." If hedgehogs or badgers could look exasperated, Jane did. She jumped off the bed and scurried to the door and went under it and out and then under it and back in. She smacked his head. "Right! We have something better than a horse. We have a... weasel? Jane rolled over and played dead. Not a weasel, my lady, but whatever you are, I am catching your meaning. You can sneak in and out and around the tower, and possibly steal a key. She nodded. And bring the key here, and we'll unlock the door, descend the stairs, take the guard at the bottom by surprise, knock him out, steal his sword to dispatch any other guards we may come across, go to the stables, steal a horse, and head for the hills. She nodded again, and this time did a scurry about the bed that sort of resembled a happy dance. Well, why didn't you say so in the first place? The way you explain it, I must say, it sounds very convoluted. Jane didn't stick around to argue. She scampered out the door, which involved flattening herself in a move that defied physics, and left G pacing and waiting and waiting and pacing, and then pacing and waiting some more, all the while looking out the window for signs of dawn. If Jane didn't return in time, escape would be impossible. He wouldn't be able to fit out the door. Maybe his captors didn't know about the daylight curse, and if Jane's plan didn't work, the sheer bulkiness of his physique would delay the whole burning at the stake thing. Or maybe they did know, and they would come to fetch him sooner than the sunrise. "Hurry, my lady," he whispered as he paced and waited. "Please hurry." Eventually, he heard the soft clinging of metal far away, and it got closer and closer, and G imagined a badger carrying a set of keys up a flight of stone stairs. He went and stood by the door, and soon enough Jane appeared underneath. She dropped a set of keys at his feet and nudged them as if she were in a hurry. He snatched them up and wondered if her getaway wasn't exactly clean. It wasn't. He heard footsteps charging up the stairwell, only there were at least 10 keys on the ring. "Which one?" he muttered. He shoved the first one in the lock and jangled it about. No luck. As he tried the second, Jane climbed up his pants and shirt and traversed across his arm as if to add urgency to the situation. "I'm going as fast as I can." Third key. The lock didn't budge. The footsteps got closer and closer. Fourth key. Nothing. Jane dug her tiny claws into his wrist. "You're not helping," G pointed out. "The guard was just outside the door."
"Where are you, you little rat?"
Jane dug her claws in again. "Don't worry, my sweet. He didn't mean it." The fifth key did the trick. The lock clicked. All three of them heard it. Just as the guard charged the heavy wooden door, G pulled it wide open. The guard fell in and G struck him on the head with the bedpost. The guard crumpled to the floor, unmoving but breathing. "Quick!" G whisked Jane up to his shoulder and grabbed the guard's sword. As he crept down the stairs, it occurred to him that as a weasel she could have saved herself and left him to die again. But when the time came, she didn't. Again. This was the perfect time of night to escape the Tower of London, mostly because it was the time with the fewest number of guards, and the ones on duty were either exhausted or sneaking sips from a hidden flask. Nevertheless, G and Jane ran into three guards. After all, they were royal prisoners. They couldn't expect to make it to the stables completely unhindered. The first guard, G dispatched quickly in a move that Jane would probably describe as elegant swordsmanship, but he knew was really the result of the sword slipping from his sweaty hand. As he lunged to retrieve it before it hit the ground, he plunged the sword through the heart of a guard who was just rounding the corner. The second encounter was not so graceful. The guard raised his sword and his other hand in a fighting stance, and G did the same, hoping it wasn't obvious he'd skipped out on half of his childhood fencing lessons in favour of playing his favourite rhyming game with one of his nannies. The two stood there for a long time, staring, preparing for... what, G wondered. Attack, counter-attack? Someone to give the go-ahead? Jane, impatient with the stare-down, scampered off G's shoulder across the floor to the guard, up his leg and inside his shirt. The guard did some strange jerky motions, not unlike a young child learning the famed estampi dance from Spain. G used the distraction to dispatch the man, making sure to aim his sword away from any bulky parts where Jane might be. The third guard came along, saw the bleeding second guard, looked at Gifford with his sword raised, a formidable sight if one wasn't aware of his sword skills, and took off running. G scooped Jane up and sprinted away as well. He started toward the stables where he'd first been held. "We must hurry," he said, trying not to imagine what he looked like talking to a hedgehog on his shoulder. "That one will probably sound an alarm. We need a horse." The little rodent dug her claws into his shoulder. "Yes, yes, but we need one that stays a horse, especially if soldiers will be chasing us soon." He opened the stable door as quietly as possible, backed inside looking for any pursuers, and when there were none, he shut the door, turned around, and nearly ran into the pointy end of a man's sword. The sword's owner was a tall man with a beard and a uniform, but not a soldier kind of uniform, more like the hired help kind. G put his hand on his rat in an automatic protective motion. "Please," he said, but before he could go on, the man lowered his sword.
"Are you Gifford?"
G didn't know if he should try to deny his identity, but there was no point. He nodded.
"Where's the Queen?"
the man said. "I'm sorry, who are you?" The man pushed by him and opened the door a crack, peeked out, and then shut it again.
"Where's the Queen?" he said again.
"I'm afraid you won't believe me if I tell you," G responded.
"Try me."
G took Jane off his shoulder, she was trembling, and cradled her in his arms.
"She's here."
The man's scowl softened, and he leaned forward with a smile.
"Ah, she's a wee ferret. She's a beautiful thing."
"Ferret!" G exclaimed. "That's what you are, my dear, a ferret!"
He'd heard of the creatures, but he'd never seen one.
"See? So much better than a rat."
The man grabbed G's arm and pulled him toward the stables.
"We'd best be getting you on your way if you have any hope of escaping."
"Who are you?" G asked again. "Are you the one who slid the letter under my door?" The man nodded.
"Name's Peter Bannister. I'm the Royal Kennel Master. I was loyal to King Edward. Sent my daughter to protect him, but a lot of good that did."
"Protect him? From what?
The affliction?"
Peter opened one of the stalls and hoisted a saddle onto the steed inside.
"From the likes of your dirty father. The king never had the affliction."
G stood still with his mouth open in surprise.
"There's no time to explain. Get on your horse. Follow my daughter. She'll lead you safely away."
While G mounted the horse with Jane on his shoulder, Peter disappeared down toward the end of the stables and out the door that led to the kennels. He returned moments later with a beautiful Afghan hound.
"There's a good girl," he said, ruffling the dog's fur. "Follow Petunia, my lord. She'll help you."
"I thought you said we were to follow your daughter."
Just then a horn blew, and then another. Peter's eyes went wide.
"Go!"
He threw open the stable doors, and then G and Jane and their horse and Petunia the dog galloped away into the night.
Part 2. In which we throw history out the window. Midlog.
Hey there, it's us, your friendly neighborhood narrators. We just wanted to take a break for a minute to tell you something important. Up until now, what we've shown you has been loosely based on what we've been able to uncover in our research, filling in the blanks where needed. But from this point on, dear reader, we're going to go deep, deep abyss to the inner crust of the earth, deep into the stuff the historians don't want you to know about, the stuff they will go to extreme lengths to hide. Because can you imagine the cost and hassle of rewriting all of the history books?
We've traversed the great plains of Hertfordshire, spelunked the dark tunnels of Piccadilly, hiked the rolling hills of the Cotswolds, searching for the descendants of our lovers and the poisoned king, and we have compiled what we so delicately refer to as the truth. Because of the danger, we considered changing our names, but we didn't. Still, we sleep with swords under our pillows. If the truth of what happened to our heroes and heroines scares you, and God's teeth, it should scare you, do not venture past this point. But if you are a bucker of the system, a friend of truth, an ally of love, and a believer in magic, then read on. 19. Edward.
"Take that, you lily-livered scut!" Gracie shouted, swinging her sword.
Edward sidestepped the blow in the nick of time. He puffed out his chest.
"That's King Lily-livered Scut to you," she laughed.
"Yes, sire," she said. "Of course. How could I forget?"
His heart was pounding from more than just the exertion of the fight. This whole sparring with a girl situation made him wildly uncomfortable. It wasn't proper, of course. What if he were to hurt her? But Gran had said that was nonsense and sent them outside to work up a sweat. Right. Edward was definitely sweating now. Gracie was making sure of that, what with the distracting trousers that hugged her in all the right places as she parried and thrust at him, her eyes bright and cheeks flushed, the sheen of her own perspiration on her forehead, and what glimpses of her neck he could see around the tumble of black curls. It was outright unfair, he thought. How could he be expected to concentrate?
"Your Majesty!"
She grinned and swiped at him again. He struck back at her lightly, a series of moves designed to impress her with his vast knowledge of swordplay, and she retreated.
"You're not bad for a girl," he said.
Her next blow glanced off his shoulder, not hard, but certainly unexpected. Somehow she'd made it past his superior defense techniques, but it must have been blind luck. He darted away, regained his footing, then advanced on her again. She retreated. She was open. She left him all kinds of vulnerable places to strike. Still, he could not bring himself to really hit her.
"Come on, sire," she scoffed as his broom gently grazed her leg. "Enough with the chivalry."
"My lady," he said gallantly, "I'm willing to stop whenever you are. Perhaps you'd be better off sticking to more womanly pursuits, like embroidery or music or..."
She bashed him in the ribs. If it had been a real sword in her hand instead of half of a broken broomstick, he would have been done for. As it was, he went to his knees, the wind knocked out of him. She rapped his hand then, hard enough that he dropped his broom, and she kicked it out of the way. Before he could reach for it, she lifted her foot and sent him sprawling into the grass. When he looked up, the blunt end of her broomstick was at his throat.
Beaten by a girl? Inconceivable.
His mind whirled with excuses. He was still getting over the effects of the poison, of course. His twisted ankle remained a bit tender, not to mention the dog bite on his leg. A broom was not the same as a good sword in your hand. It was a poor replacement, in fact, different to balance, difficult to hold. The sun was in his eyes.
"Do you yield?" she asked.
He laughed up at her and rubbed his knuckles where she'd struck him.
"Hey, that hurt."
"Oh, I'm so sorry, sire,"
Gracie said, but she didn't look sorry.
"Now, does England yield?"
"To Scotland?"
"Aye."
"Never!"
He grabbed her broom, a move he'd never be able to pull off with a real sword, and pulled her down to him. They wrestled, which gave Edward some lovely opportunities to touch her, to feel the gentle curves of her body against his. But Gracie was a wild thing in his arms, and not in the good way, although it certainly wasn't in a bad way either. Within moments she'd somehow managed to flip him and was sitting on his chest, pinning his arms.
inconceivable.
Do you yield? She asked breathlessly.
He was going to say no again, but then he got to looking at her eyelashes, which were so long that they cast shadows on her rosy cheeks, and he knew he'd say yes to just about anything she asked of him.
Yes, he conceded, I yield.
He looked up at her, panting. I'm a bit rusty, I'm afraid. That, and before now, people usually had let him win.
She got off him and picked up her broom. He tried not to look disappointed.
You're getting better, she said, although he knew she wasn't referring to his fighting, but his condition in general. He was getting better.
Even after a mere 2 days at the abandoned castle under Gran's torturous but effective care, his body felt stronger, his thoughts clearer. He hardly coughed any more.
He was going to live.
Gracie reached down to offer to help him to his feet.
Do you want to make a real go of it now, sire? Are we done playing with our dolls?
Call me Edward, he said, scrambling up without her help. She dropped back into fighting stance. Edward grabbed his broom out of the grass. He wiped sweat off his brow and smiled. Take that, you beef-witted varlet! He made an honest try at hitting her this time. She dodged easily, almost skipped out of his way.
Edward had the sudden suspicion that up to now she'd been going easy on him.
Who are you calling beef-witted? She laughed at him. Your mother was a hamster, and your father stank of elderberries.
And away they went, whirling and stabbing with their brooms, almost dancing as they moved about the field. She was good. Really good.
Where did you learn to fight like this? He panted as she nearly disarmed him again.
Not for the first time it occurred to him that in spite of the hours he'd spent in Gracie's company, he still knew next to nothing about her.
She tossed her hair out of her face, then brought her broom down hard against his. He only just managed to push her off.
It was just something I picked up along the way, she answered, as slippery as ever when it came to this type of question. I prefer knives, though. Nothing beats a sharp knife in your boot.
Along your way to where? He pressed. Why are you in England?
Mind your own business.
She jabbed at him with her broom, but he parried.
You beetle-headed, flap-eared knave!
A laugh burst from him. You canker blossom! He cried, aiming a blow that made her duck.
But seriously, Gracie, don't you think it's about time you told me something about yourself?
What you see is what you get, sire.
She gave him a quick bow, then swung at him again. You poisonous bunchback toad.
Sire, again. He might have preferred toad.
Enough, he sighed, then suddenly threw his broomstick to the ground. I don't want to play games anymore.
Gracie lowered her own broomstick uncertainly.
Sire?
Perhaps you'd better be on your way, Gracie. I appreciate all you've done for me, but I'm sure you have better things to do than play at swords. You said you would see me to my grandmother, and you did. You don't have to stay.
His heart was beating fast again. He was taking a gamble, he knew, calling her bluff. Her eyebrows came together.
You don't trust me? After everything?
I want to trust you. Really, I do, but I don't know you, he said. I'm grateful for what you've done to help me, but I don't understand your reasons for doing so. You could be a spy for Mary, Queen of Scots, for all I know. He shuddered at the thought.
Gracie stared at him for a few tense heartbeats, her brows still furrowed, and then she let the broomstick drop to the ground.
Fine, she said irritably. Come on.
She walked to the edge of the grounds where the forest began, away from the ruins of the castle and out of earshot of anyone who might hear them. He followed. She spent a few minutes picking up pieces of wood from the forest floor and then throwing them down again, as if she was searching for something. He hoped that she hadn't at long last decided that he wasn't worth all this aggravation and was choosing a branch to club him with. Finally, she seemed to find one she liked. She sat down against an elm tree. Edward lowered himself to the ground a few feet away. He waited for her to speak.
"You asked me once when it was that I knew I was a fox."
She drew her knife out of her boot and started stripping down the piece of wood in her hand.
"I was 7.
She was going to tell him a sad story. He could tell by the way the light had gone out of her remarkable eyes. He was tempted to stop her, because he hated sad stories, and he had no right to demand something so personal from her. But then again, there was truth to what he'd just told her. He needed to know who she was. Gracie was deftly shaping the wood with her knife, her gaze fixed on her work, so she didn't have to look at him as she talked.
"That night I woke to our cottage burning. We were all inside, my ma and da and brothers. I had 2 brothers, and they'd blocked the door from the outside, boarded the windows too."
"The English," he said, and she didn't answer, but if it had been anyone else, he knew she would have corrected him.
"My family was all Athians, as I told you. My da was a beautiful red stag, and my mum a doe, which is why they got on so well. My brother Fergus was a black horse with a white star on his forehead." She laughed softly. "My brother Daniel was a big lumbering hound. Myself, I'd never changed before. That night was the first time."
She fell silent. Edward shifted uncomfortably.
"The rest of my family were too big to get out of the cottage," she continued after a moment. "Only I could squeeze out. My dad told me I had to go. He said I should make my way south to a convent in France where I had an aunt. He even drew me a kind of map as the house was filling with smoke and tied it to my neck with my mum's handkerchief."
She closed her eyes.
"Why?"
Edward asked softly. "The English soldiers just burned houses with people inside them?"
"They burned any place that housed Athians."
With her knife, she stabbed at the piece of wood fiercely, chips littering the ground near her feet. The carving was taking on a shape now, but Edward couldn't tell what.
"And they burned the homes of those who would protect them?"
He wasn't so naive as to deny that such things had happened. Under his father's orders, undoubtedly, Edward wanted to believe that, as king, he wouldn't have authorized this kind of abuse, but even in that he wasn't entirely sure. He'd been awfully hands-off in the running of the country. He'd signed the papers his advisers had thrust at him. He'd trusted them to do what was best for the kingdom. The world felt different to him now. He felt different.
"Did you ever make it to France?" he asked.
She gave a bitter laugh.
"I tried. I lost the map after the first week, so after that I just ran south until my paws bled. I nearly starved because I hadn't yet learned to hunt or steal. I would have died if..."
She stopped whittling momentarily and swallowed hard, like this next part pained her to speak of even more than losing her family.
"If?"
Edward prompted gently when she didn't finish her thought. She looked up and met his eyes.
"If the pack hadn't phoned me?"
Edward sucked in a breath.
"Oh,"
he said, trying to sound like this was no big deal.
"The pack. They weren't always so bad as they are now," Gracie explained. "In the beginning, the pack was about securing safety for the Athian people. Yes, we stole and we plundered, and occasionally we got into unfortunate scrapes with certain soldiers, but for the most part we kept to the shadows. We survived. We helped one another."
She brushed an errant curl from her face.
"The leader was like a father to me. He took me in when I had no one else. He taught me everything I know, and not just how to get by. He taught me to read and write, mend a shirt, figure numbers, handle a bow,
a sword, a knife, carve and whittle, and he also taught me history and philosophy and the like. What happened to him?
He asked, because he knew from her clouded expression that something had, not long ago, he thought.
He got old,
Gracie resumed her whittling.
Another man, Thomas Archer is his name, challenged him for the leadership and won. After that, things were different. Archer believes that Ethians should do more than simply survive. He believes that we are one with nature, and therefore we should dominate it, take what we want, punish anyone who would challenge or harm Ethians. Archer gathered up a group of men who become wolves, and they started to go about making trouble.
So you left, Edward assumed.
Yes.
She frowned in concentration as she began working on the finer details of her carving.
I went off one night and didn't return, which didn't sit well with Archer. I was useful to him.
So that's why you were so keen to avoid them? She coughed lightly.
Yes. Archer put a price on my head.
How much? Edward asked. She glanced at him.
Why do you want to know?
We're short of money, of course. Every little bit helps. She caught on that he was joking. Her dimples appeared.
10 sovereigns?
His eyes widened.
10 sovereigns? How fast can we get to this Archer fellow?
The pack uses a tavern as their headquarters, she said matter-of-factly, as if turning her in was a real possibility. The shaggy dog. It's about 30 minutes' ride from here, I'd say.
She was finished with her carving. She wiped her knife and slid it gently back into her boot. Edward leaned forward to look at the figure. It was a fox, which actually bore a remarkable resemblance to Gracie in her Ethian form, gracefully suspended in the act of running.
"Is there anything you can't do?"
he asked. "Needlepoint," she said, smiling. She put the fox into his hand.
"I can only carve foxes. Everything else I try ends up looking like a lumpy dog."
Together they gazed down at the little wooden fox.
"It's nice,"
he murmured.
"Thank you." "You're welcome."
"I only have one more question, then,"
he said. She nodded.
"Ask it."
"If the English killed your family, forced you from your home, hunted you, hurt you at every turn, then why did you help me?
And don't give me that rot about being a friend to the pathetic creatures of the world. Tell me why."
It was the first time he'd ever seen her look embarrassed. She gave a little sigh. "The truth?"
"The truth."
"I liked the look of you." He sat back amazed. He thought, although he wasn't entirely sure, that she meant that she'd found him good-looking.
You had kind eyes, a nice smile." She was blushing.
"This was wonderful, wonderful news."
"Have you seen your own eyes?" he said impulsively. "Green, like forest moss."
"Moss?"
"Like pools of..." He cursed himself that he was not more of a poet.
"Yes."
Her lips twitched as she clearly tried not to laugh at him.
"Beautiful eyes," he stumbled on.
"Pools of beautiful eyes?"
"Yes, exactly. And your hair, and your smile as well, is so... And you're funny and clever, and brave. I've never met a girl like you."
"Oh, I'm not so very brave."
She was looking at him. That way. He could smell her, the lavender soap from Gran's bathtub mixed with a woodsy smell that never seemed to leave her. He glanced down at her mouth, he couldn't help it, and, miracle of all miracles, she looked down at his. He wet his lips nervously. What if he didn't do it correctly? What if their noses bumped? What if she found his lips chapped? What if his breath was foul?
Gracie, he murmured, her name a kind of music on his lips. Grace. Their faces were close, almost close enough. His heart started to beat like a war drum. He inched even closer. Sire, she breathed. Please call me Edward, he said. Things don't have to be so formal between us. Before he lost his nerve, he reached out and tucked one of her wild curls behind her ear. He leaned in. This was it. His first kiss. His first kiss.
Boy! Yelled a distant voice. Where are you, boy? Grace drew back abruptly.
Your granny is calling you.
She can wait, he said. It's time for your medicine, Gran called out. Gracie jumped to her feet.
You should go in.
Boy!
She hastily brushed off her trousers.
Besides, I just remembered some chores your sister wanted me to get done. Some very important chores, full of tasks.
Tasks? Edward said, doubtful.
Yes, tasks. Lots of them.
Gracie, he started as she backed away from him. Wait! Get in here, boy!
He watched helplessly as Gracie set off toward the keep, almost at a run.
Boy!
At that moment, we should confess that Edward briefly considered murdering his dear sweet grandmother, and he might have gotten away with it too on account of the rest of the world thinking the old lady was already dead. When he entered the keep, Gran was waiting for him with one of her nasty potions.
Ah, there you are, boy. Drink up.
I wish you'd stop calling me boy, he muttered.
And what would you have me call you?
I'm a man, he said.
She threw back her grizzled head and laughed heartily.
That's cute. Tell me another one.
She handed him a steaming goblet. He protested. How much of this stuff are you going to make me drink anyway? The poison is gone, isn't it? This tastes like rotten apples. But she made him choke it down. Gran had made him suffer through many terrible things in the name of ridding his body of the poison. The first day, in addition to the rotten apple brew she made him guzzle by the jugful, she'd forced him to stand for 20 minutes under the spray of an icy waterfall, then bathe in a tub of boiled milk. On the second day, she'd wrapped a chicken gizzard around his neck, stuck a lump of charcoal under his tongue, and made him say the alphabet backward.
What was the alphabet part for?
He'd asked after he finally reached A.
Nothing, Gran had chortled. I just wanted to hear you say it.
Gran delighted in torturing him.
And when you're done with that, go see your sister, if you're not feeling too manly to speak with a woman.
Gran chortled now as he gulped down the last of the potion. He did what she told him, but only because he'd been wanting to talk to Bess anyway. Not because he was a little boy who was scared of his grandmother. He found his sister waiting for him in his chamber.
Come, sit,
she said, and pointed him to a chair. Edward sat. On the table in front of him there was a map of Europe with several wooden figures placed upon it in strategic positions. The figures all resembled lumpy dogs, one of the ways Gracie was making herself useful. His gaze fell on London. And he turned his thoughts to Jane. Bess had a network of Ethian raven spies at the Tower of London, and occasionally a raven made its way to Helmsley with news, the most recent of which being that the new Queen Mary had rounded up all the known Ethians on the staff and meant to make an example of them in a large bonfire at the end of the month. And after that, she was planning to send soldiers into London to gather up the Ethians from there as well. Mary's purge of Ethians was already well underway. But in spite of Bess's best efforts, there had strangely been no word of what had become of his cousin.
It was as if Jane and Gifford had simply up and vanished from London the same day that Mary had arrived there. Edward assumed that Mary probably had Jane secretly locked up in a tower somewhere, if he knew his sister, but he also knew Jane, and he knew Jane could be spirited when challenged, and Mary taking away her throne would be the biggest challenge of all. His cousin had a troublesome habit of speaking her mind in tense situations, and Mary was easily offended and rather too fond of saying off with her head. In other words, Edward was worried. But they couldn't rescue Jane or stop the Ethian bonfire. Not yet. They weren't ready to take on Mary's considerable forces, i.e. the English army. At least, not according to Bess, who seemed to be working out a plan. Edward looked over the map and the wooden figures on the table before him. "These are parts of an army?" he asked Bess incredulously. "Whose?" Her lips turned up in what was not quite a smile.
"Mine. I have my contacts, my favours owed. When I found out that you were being poisoned and Mary was building a secret army to make herself queen, I thought I might put together a secret army of my own."
She smoothed her hand over the map and her smile vanished.
"But it's not enough men, Edward. Mary's army is greater by half. She has the support of both the Spanish and the Holy Roman Emperor. The Spanish armada is formidable. Unbeatable, they say. I don't know yet how we're going to overcome them."
He glanced up at his sister. Her face was drawn in concentration. She was staring at a line of ships in the English Channel. "Who do these belong to?" he asked, picking up a ship and turning it over in his hand.
"France. I believe their King Henry will support you, not Mary, as the rightful monarch, once he sees that you're alive. He's got to be afraid of a woman usurping the throne the way she did. It's the only solution I can think of."
Edward had underestimated Bess. He knew that now. She knew the world in a way that Edward himself didn't fully understand.
"If we could get ships and troops from France,"
Bess continued, almost to herself,
"and perhaps at the same time seek the support of Mary, Queen of Scots, reinforcements from Scotland, then we might stand a chance."
He felt his face drain of colour. "Did you say Mary, Queen of Scots?" Bess didn't seem to notice his dismay.
"Of course, who knows the state of the Scottish army? And help from the French king won't come cheap. He'll want something from you in return, probably, and you'll forever be in his debt if you succeed. But it's the only way. The only way to regain his throne, to save Jane."
Edward swallowed. "Sounds like I'm going to France," he said lightly, but his heart was beating fast. "When do I leave?" Bess bit her lip.
"I want you to rest a few days more. Gather your strength. You're going to need it."
"Can't we send someone to retrieve Jane?"
"Who would we send? Gran?"
Bess shook her head. "Gran's not a terrible idea."
"I know Jane is dear to you," Bess said. "I also know that she's in danger. But Jane is one person, Edward. There are thousands of lives at stake. There's a kingdom on the edge of a knife. We must tread carefully."
He sighed. On the map, London was just a finger's length from Helmsley, but Jane was very far away.
"Very well," he said tersely. "A few more days, and I'll depart for France."
He rose from the chair, crossed to the window, and slung his leg up onto the sill. He wanted to be a bird now. Then he could fly away to Jane, to at least tell her that he hadn't forgotten her, that he was coming for her, even if it took longer than he meant to. Bess slipped out of the room behind him, closing the door.
"I'm sorry," he whispered.
The sky overhead was blue and beckoning, but he resisted the call. "I am sorry, Jane." A wave of melancholy overtook him. "Oh, Janie, where are you?"
20. Jane, as it happened, was fleeing for her life. After escaping the city, they'd started in some direction. Still in her ferret state, Jane clung to Gifford's shoulder while he rode their stolen horse out of London as fast as they could go. Pet ran on ahead of them, leading the way to where, Jane couldn't tell. It was away from Mary's soldiers, that was all that mattered. The roads would be the first place anyone would look, so they diverted into the forest. The hooves of their stolen steed beat the ground in a relentless tempo. Hounds bayed in the distance, making Pet lift her nose to the wind. It seemed their pursuers gained on them. Jane huddled in the curve of Gifford's neck, terrified and exhausted, as they veered here and there, lost in the dark, dark night. Gifford hunched lower over the horse. Jane scrambled to adjust her weight, but he scooped her up and held her against his chest.
"I have a plan," he said.
Wonderful. Jane loved plans. He glanced down at her.
"It's a good plan, I think."
Jane bit him, not hard, urging him to just get it out.
"Shortly, the sun will rise, and I will begin my daily departure from my two-legged self to my four-legged self, and then we will be able to move more quickly. I'll send my equine friend here off on another path to create a diversion. Meanwhile, you will remain in your ferrety form, and I will carry you somewhere safe."
Jane cocked her head. It wasn't a terrible plan, although it was a tad vague. But what about horse rule number 3, no riding the horse? Gifford shook his head.
"I know what you're thinking, dear, but now's not the time for such rules. We need to be fast. You weigh next to nothing in this form. As long as we can find a way to secure you to me without the use of those magnificent claws, I'll be able to run at top speed."
That sounded good to Jane.
"Excellent," said Gifford. "I'm glad we're agreed."
They careened down a narrow deer trail. The minutes stretched like hours. With the trees growing tall and ancient all around them, it was difficult to track the moon and stars, but eventually the woods lightened to a soft purple, and birds began to sing, and Jane felt herself breathe more easily. This terrible night was almost over, and she'd survived it. They were still being hunted down like dogs, sure, but things never seemed as bad in the light of day. Gifford called to Pet and reined in the horse. They were just slowing to a trot when Jane changed. One instant she was a ferret cupped in Gifford's hand and pressed against his chest. The next she was engulfed in a blinding white light, and then she was a girl, sitting sideways on the saddle with her legs hanging off one side, and she was most definitely naked. Their stolen horse snorted and stopped, disgusted with the sudden weight of two people.
"Jane, this wasn't part of the plan."
Gifford untied his cloak and threw it around her shoulders.
"You didn't bite me when I explained it, so I assumed we were in agreement."
Jane scrambled off the saddle and landed in an undignified heap on the ground. She tried to get up, but her legs were wobbly after the sudden transformation. Gifford dismounted and knelt beside her.
"Are you all right?"
She nodded. There'd been so much she'd wanted to tell him before, when she'd been locked in the tower, but now, possibly for the first time in her life, Jane felt tongue-tied. Gifford looked like he wanted to say something, too. He took her hands in his, fingers grazing the rings of cuts and bruises on her wrists from the shackles, and she sucked in a sharp breath. Her wrists hadn't hurt so much as a ferret, though there'd been a shadow of pain. Now they felt like they were on fire.
"You're wounded," Gifford observed.
"It's nothing." She tried to smile at him. "So, I suppose I can't control the change yet." He arched an eyebrow at her.
"What's that you say? You can't control the change? How's that
possible when you've read so very many books on Ethians? Her face felt hot. She sat up straighter.
Well, these are just less than ideal conditions. I will be able to perfect the change with a bit of practice, I'm sure.
Oh, I'm sure you will. You should try. Change back and we'll go, he said.
He was teasing her. She wasn't sure if she liked it. She took a deep breath and concentrated on the idea of becoming a ferret again, because that was the plan.
But nothing happened. She tried again. Nothing.
Gifford's gaze dropped to her collarbone, then the shape of her under the cloth.
Wait. Never mind. Stay just like...